This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to Jikoji on this beautiful summer day. My goodness. Compassion Light Temple. I've seen some wonderful changes since I was here last. Everything is really looking very beautiful and together. And since there are a number of us, we won't do names, but we'll have an opportunity to meet one another and talk with old friends at the social lunch, which Jikoji friends and volunteers cook up for us. It's such a great tradition that Jikoji that Jikoji has with that. So I'm having a little dripping. I'll try to keep my voice up, and I hope you can all hear me now. but I may have to clear my throat from time to time. So I look forward to meeting some of you and chatting with you at lunchtime, and hope you can stay. So today I'd like to share with you some reflections from my reading and rereading of the Sandokai. This is a very important text for Soto Zen practitioners. We study it and discuss it, and I'm again talking about it for the third time through my teacher's lineage, Angie Enjo, Voice of N, our floating Zendo Sangha, is looking at this and reflecting on it, and bringing our own insights into it, or taking what it can offer us. The Sandokai is a short poem, about 44 lines in most translations, written by Sekito, that's the Japanese version of his, of Shitu, through the Chan lineage that Dogen, our founder, eventually took back some of the teachings to Japan. He traveled widely in China for a certain period, studying and practicing with many teachers, and came to his realization of what he felt was most important to take. Zazen, Shiken Taza. We've been looking at Suzuki Roshi's commentary, which is called Branching Streams in the Darkness Flow, which is from a line in the Sendokai. And there are many, many practitioners over the centuries. This was written in the 8th century or mid-8th century in China by Sekito, have done commentaries and written, and there are texts and commentaries in Chinese and Japanese and English and other languages. And many, many more practitioners have studied it and taken these amazing words in. The Sandokai, the translation that Suzuki Roshi uses is the harmony of difference and equality. And in its few short lines, it's just incredibly rich and deep. The whole poem is like a koan. It's a kind of koan. And within the poem, there are many koans. So Sekito has a commonality with Dogen, is that he's very good at using poetic language, and he has these wonderful lines in the Sandokai that just kind of like koans, have the possibility of that our minds will have a little brightness around these words, these koans. So since it's really rich and we have a short amount of time here today, I won't be discussing the whole Sendokai because that's a year's study or a lifetime study to return to. But I'll just pick out some things and give you my reflection of what I think is one of the most important things that the Sendokai brings to us. And that's its, although it touches many aspects of practice, it most fundamentally speaks of how to live with our deep tendencies to set one thing against another. How we like to compare and contrast and make this right and this wrong. So one of the we only do that with the exterior world, but we do it within ourselves too. We set ourselves against ourselves sometimes. It's kind of amazing, but that's what happens. That's the way we do things as human beings. We usually see things as black or white or gray or something, some color, something. And then we grab onto one view, and then we just really hold on to that. There are biological reasons for that, because of the way we're constituted as humans. We're binocular and we're binaural. And we are bipedal, we walk, we're kind of divided up into twos and twos. We have a bicameral mind. So that's what is part of us. Yet there's more to us than that. There's much more to us than that. And that's what Sekito is pointing to in the harmony of difference and equality. And that's what our Zen practice does. It opens the door to experience that harmony with our whole mind, heart, body. Because as much as we're sort of set up biologically and in a byway, we're also one whole, and we're also one whole, one totality with everything else. And that's where it gets tricky for us, because we have this strong sense that we're really separate from everything else, which is true in a way. It's absolutely true. But that's not the whole. That's not the whole thing. So, in this, the koan and this Zen practice we do, even when we don't do formal koan, when we do zazen, when we do shikantaza, just sitting, it's a mystery how that unfolds. And Sekito recognizes this mystery. And he points to it again in different ways. We're separate, and yet we're not apart from the world. We couldn't exist as really separate. That's even completely illogical. But the harmony that we practice when we sit down, and that Sekito points to, is in a way beyond language and beyond reason. We can't figure it out, so we just sit with it. But we have a strong propensity to know things and want to know things, and that's also natural, useful, and helpful. But then we just somehow lose track of the fact that behind the knowing and behind the logic and the reason, the wanting to know, there's always a bigger picture. There's always something more. And then we kind of tend to think we know things and say this is this way and this is that way. But really, what do we know? We can say we know. Fundamentally, there's these other Zen koan-like phrases that point to this. Do we really know where we come from? We can come up with lots of reasons we can come up with, from the most banal to, you know, like our parents, to cosmic reasons of, you know, our atoms are the same as, you know, the atoms in the cosmos. But that just keeps putting the question further and further off. Do we really know where we come from? There's that phrase in Zen. Oh, what was your face before you were born? And do we really know where we're going? Well, we all have some sense of, yes, there will be an end. There will be a time when we stop breathing. We kind of know that in some way. But then, where do we go from there? Do we know? Certainly we can have intuitions about that or apprehensions about it or lots of speculations. Religions are good at speculating about where we might go when we're no longer here, knowing our lives as we know them now, as breathing beings, breathing, apprehending, conscious beings. So there's an American poet, Robinson Jeffers, who's lived very close to here in Carmel in the early 20th century. And I'd like to quote from one of his works in regard to this. He says, he's a poet, so he uses this language to talk about this mystery. As we must uncenter our minds from ourselves. What is this thing called life? There are many forms of consciousness, the earth, the oceans, the mountains, the rocks, the whole glittering universe. So early in the Sendokai, Sekito describes the mystery or points to it, you know, very simply by saying the mind of the great sage of India is transmitted intimately. The great way has no northern and no southern ancestors. So that right away we're kind of outside of time. It's transmitted intimately to all of us. The way, the Buddha way, is beyond the distinctions of northern and southern. So there's a little historical piece to that. In that era, in China, there were schools of Buddhism called the Northern and Southern, and they lived appropriately in different regions of more southerly and northerly regions of China. And they each thought clearly, whole temples and traditions of monk practitioners said, our way is the right way, our way is the great way. And they both, these schools believed that. And then there came a figure in our Chinese ancestors, Huineng, who was an amazing figure because he exemplifies, his story is so inspiring, he exemplifies that how the mind is transmitted and how anyone can tune into it. He was an orphan and very poor. He sold scrap kindling wood in the marketplaces in a small town, in small towns in southern China. And one day as he was going through the market doing his selling, he overheard a monk chant one verse of the Diamond Sutra, and he had an insight. He had what's called a great awakening, which any of us can have. So here are some words that Seikito uses, these koan-like phrases, these great poetic phrases. All the objects of senses interact and yet do not. Then he says, light and dark oppose one another like front and back foot walking. And phenomena exist like box and lid joining. So for me, these phrases, and there are many more in this poem, but they point to unhooking ourselves from our narrow views. And our narrow views are often justified by our perceived definitions of what's right and logical and reasonable. But many of these reasons are, in fact, our emotional reactions to things, or they contain within them. We can have a superficially logical explanation of why this is right and this is wrong, but often there's something that drives us to hold on to it, to grasp it. And that's some kind of emotion that we're not really aware of. And the Sandokai and our practice, mostly through our practice, but Sandokai offers these pointers that allow us to step back and to step into the open and get a sense of how there's a lot more going on than what we think. And this is even the things that we make these judgments about, things we love and think are beautiful, and the things we dislike and think are evil. But even those are part of something larger, part of something bigger. That's a mystery, but that's the way it is. It's true. It's all here. The things we don't like, the things that are not good, that we have to make stands about. So this stepping back and seeing the larger picture doesn't mean that we don't make a stand about things, that we don't know how to act. In fact, the stepping back is like the opening to, it allows a space for creative solutions to arise. So instead of just lamenting and bemoaning or complaining, or worse, complaining about, or even worse, getting angry and worse for us and not so good for the whole environment around us either, getting angry about things we don't like, the stepping back gives us space to allow solutions perhaps to arise, both in the exterior world and within ourselves, because we often have things we don't like about ourselves, too. So the largeness of this world, perhaps you've had the experience when you're out camping or anywhere away from a city and can look up at the night sky and see what's going on outside of where we're standing or lying down, our little place. It's very big. It's kind of unlikely that that exists. All of this around us exists, and we exist together with it. I mean, we take it for granted, but opening up to see that it's so puts us in touch with the deeper part of ourselves, the wellsprings of generosity and joy and love and wisdom, the parts that help us come to knowing what to do with our lives, what to do in any situation we find ourselves in. So the skies, I just spent some time looking at the sky a lot, and it was very dark where I was. And I was just amazed, like, these skies are not, we have this relationship to them. And it's not just the air we breathe, although there's certainly the atmosphere, but the stars, the what we know of the cosmos, our little planetary slice of it, our human race has been able to navigate the oceans by the stars and by the daylight skies. You know, people navigating well before GPS. They because they understood that they're part of it. They paid attention to it, the bigger picture. So in the short time we have today, I'd like to move on to the last lines of the Sendokai. And Sekito says, I respectfully urge you who study the mystery, do not pass your days and nights in vain. So we all have a thirst for the harmony and the mystery. That's why we're all here. We're here really looking into things, looking out at things, looking at this bigger picture. And it seems odd, but that's just one of the many contradictions that's true in the world, that by turning inward and facing the wall, we open up to the larger picture. We wake up to be starting to be aware moment by moment that the way is undivided and we're part of it, and we can be part of it at any moment, that we just become aware of it. The one thing we study is our confusion and our delusion, and that's for sure, that's part of us too, but as I said, there are also that the wellsprings, the other parts, the deeper parts. Sometimes we can just get caught up in just thinking it's only one layer. And that's why Zazen brings us to remembering. Even when a lot of thoughts are going on in our head, or we're having emotions and being kind of this way and that way on the cushion, something is going on. Something is working in us. Part of this mystery is working in us. And it shows up at any time. It can show up on the cushion, and it can show up away from the cushion. So seems like sometimes we just trip over our feet. And the Sando Kai kind of opens our eyes, and sitting practice opens our eyes, so we kind of see where we're going instead of tripping over ourselves. The sitting practice is the essential part of bringing body, mind, and heart together so that we know we're not divided and we know that there's a possibility of making creative choices. So we can untangle ourselves from our fixities and our grasping, our confusion, and our feeling of separateness and fear. We see that we're the whole and the parts, we're the box and the lid, that the front and the back foot are working together. There's some other Zen phrases came to mind when I was making notes on the Sando Kai, my book. We can stop putting heads on our heads and trying to figure things out. And then, in those times we get confused and feel we're lost and just like, what am I doing here? What am I doing? What is the world doing? We can also, through continuing practice, stop beating our heads against the walls. We can see that we don't need to shore ourselves up. We don't need to defend ourselves with right and wrong. And that's usually our go-to. That's as humans. And that's partly habit. And there are also biological reasons for that. I mean, making distinctions and deciding what's right and wrong, it's very functional in situations of danger. And so that's very deeply embedded in us. But we're not there now. We're not there where we have to react to every shadow that moves around the tree that could be a tiger going to jump on us. We're in a different place as human beings, and we have the great gift and benefit of the way intimately transmitted to us and through all of our ancestors. So we can get a little spacious. So last Tuesday was a full moon, and the chant I say on full moon has the lines, all my ancient wrong actions from beginningless greed, hatred, and delusion, based on mind, speech, and body, I now fully avow. So what a relief. What a relief it is to just be human. I mean, we can't escape it, and just... So we can acknowledge our confusion. We can acknowledge that's the way we are. And yet we cannot say, well, okay, that's the way we are. What can we do about that? We can open to the other parts of us. We can acknowledge and move on. We can let it go. We don't have to deny that we have those tendencies as humans, but we also don't have to enact them. We can enact our other tendencies of generosity, of love, of compassion. So I'm not saying it's simple to be human. It's not. But practice is how we remember to be present and to be with everything. Practice moves us to recall all of ourselves and how we are all related to all others, even those we don't like, even those we feel are wrong, and even evil or destructive. So I know for myself, sometimes throughout my life, including in my practice life now, it's just sometimes these moments come when you just like, whoa, wow. And then it feels like around whatever issue, I was confused and tightened and wrapped up in, or whatever person or whatever situation, it's like, then I just remember, oh, there's the other part. There's another way. And it's not like you have to remember in so many words. It just, the practice works on you. It just comes. And then it's like, put that down. It feels like, whoa, I was pushing that wheelbarrow up a long hill with a load full of dirt. So, wow. And then then something else comes up, and there's a possibility to, oh, I could do this about that. So I think I'd like to end with paraphrasing Seki To. I respectfully urge you who study the mystery to practice and discover your own deepest harmonies. And I thank you for your attention, and I hope you have something to add, some questions about this conversation, which has so far been very one-sided.
It struck me as you were talking about the biological imperative of being constantly vigilant for danger, and that's something that people in wartime situations are dealing with all the time, whether they're soldiers or civilians, and it seems quite evident that this is poignant and destructive, shall we say, in the sense that there's not that space that you're talking about. And do you have any sense help?
Well, thank you for bringing that in. It's a big subject, and it's huge. It's why it's what you point to, exactly what happens when we collectively get so caught up in our fear and cling to our idea of right and wrong. What happens is war. This is human history. We cannot deny that. So what we each as individuals can do is up to us. I believe, along with all the Buddhists that I know, that our practice is a huge help in ways which we may or may not know. At the same time, we can also be active in the world with this. And I personally know someone who is a Zen priest in Southern California, Joe Bobro, who has a group that's dedicated to, I can't think of the name of it offhand, but it's dedicated to helping veterans come into some kind of harmony. He's quite, so perhaps I can, that name will come to me and the name of his group, and I'll make a note to get that to you if you want directly to do something personally. Or perhaps you have other avenues. Perhaps you are a veteran, or perhaps you know people in your family and you can do something on your own, or with a group of others. I mean, each of us, the pain is very great. That's true. And so that's why it's often hard to see. But that's why we need to keep practicing to see that there is space, even in the pain, without denying the pain of others or of ourselves. There is still possibility for wisdom, wise action to take place. But that can only come from an openness, not from a reactivity. Thank you.
You say, where do we come from and where will we go? And I was wondering, how would reincarnation affect this? Don't we know where we came from? Don't we know what we're going back to, at least temporarily?
Well, I don't. So there are many, specifically if... To answer that question, don't we know where we came from and where we're going? There are many views, and there are many postulates, speculations, incredible mythological stories, incredible belief systems around reincarnation or rebirth, and many other systems, but specifically to reincarnation, just within Buddhism and other religions, there are those that believe that they have a very clear idea of where they came from and where we're going, or a clear general idea. From my understanding of the early Buddhist texts, I don't know, and it's something that the Buddha in the early text refused to address. Although the early texts, like the Mahayana, the Pali Canon is encyclopedic, and so there are differing stories. So there are people that believe one way and people that believe another way about reincarnation. So I can only say that I don't know. I honestly do not know.
I'm going to bring up a circumstance meeting where to your point of the strife that's going on, how some nonviolent movements have arisen, and in one circumstance in India, it was with even though the people oppressed had some weapons, knives and old guns and things like that, the leaders like Gandhi and Ghafur Khan were proposing taking a position of righteousness as well as patience. And with those two qualities assembled nonviolent armies to meet the oppression. So anyway, it's something that I want to explore more, but it's, I don't know how to talk about it right now.
Thank you, Doug. Yeah, there are many ways, and there are many movements. And thank you for bringing in India. That reminds me too of and bringing in patience. That reminds me. Both of those remind me of. Joanna Macy's work, who is a Buddhist teacher and a social activist, who with a Sri Lankan Buddhist politician, this was years ago, before Sri Lanka got into their own delusions. They began a movement and a group of people, which still goes on, called the 500 years. Yes, there's all this going on. There's war. There's the environment. There's all. There's everything. And yet, just looking at that is overwhelming. So, the righteousness that you mentioned that Gandhi brought, there. We have to be clear in our intention and our integrity. We have to keep returning to, yes, I will not allow this, and yes, I will need to move from my integrity, which is nonviolent, and I will need to keep at it, even beyond my lifetime. I did a very powerful exercise of Joanna Macy's where a whole group of us went, and it was particularly around the environment, we went back in history with our eyes closed, walking backwards around a room to where we were, as far as we knew, where we came from, through all of our through all of our ancestors, human, all of our animal ancestors, back to our molecules, as far as we know where we come from, back to our atoms, cellular little creatures that still live out in the sea. Very powerful. And then we went forward through the next to our, I've forgotten now whether it was the seventh or eighth generation of our children, of our grandchildren, of our, so we went through that, and it was a powerful exercise in integrating that patience and moving from a place of, yes, I am here now, and I can do things now. And all of what we do affects one another. We are all part of the totality, as Sekito says. Mark.
I just want to thank you for, it feels like a soothing balm, your words in an inflamed time. And I want to thank you for that very much.
Thank you, Mark. I do believe it doesn't help to keep picking away at the, you know, we have to heal ourselves and come from a place of wisdom, clarity, righteousness, to act effectively. And we don't know the outcome. We don't know if our wholehearted effort is for a certain outcome. That's what we can bring with like-minded people. That's what we can do, like that Sangha, working with like-minded people. Sitting together here is an act. So thank you all again. I'm not sure where we are with time, but
it's lunchtime.
It's lunchtime. we also need to think about food and this beautiful lunch. So thank you all again.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.